You are listening to the For Liberos Tech Podcast, episode 124, New Building Blocks at Microsoft.
Welcome to episode 124 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is February the 9th, 2014. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and this is my brick-building brother, James Furlough.
Yeah, that's right. Though I'm not really building bricks, I'm building snowmen. I'll get there.
Okay.
Because I am completely snowed in. Everything I was going to do this weekend got canceled, which is why it is we're doing this early. I mean, it's like I had meetings. I had one big meeting on Saturday, totally canceled. I had on Sunday, I had to say I had a meeting, I had church, and then the podcast. And of those five, all four of them got canceled.
Well, I'm here for you, James, because we had a crazy week of weather this week.
Oh, I bet you did.
As of today, we've had our 1/8 inch of rain this entire winter.
Wow. It's actually
it's horrible. It's actually really terrifying. Or not. Well, I say terrifying and it sounds like, oh no, good weather, that's terrifying. But like if you're not from California, the summer droughts, like everything burns, the whole state burns to the ground, and we've had really bad fires in the last couple of years, so this is bad.
But not everything is bad, because you did something good last Friday.
Oh, I did. Friday night, I went to the opening day of the Lego Movie.
Is it as amazing as it should be?
It's fantastic. It is actually really fantastic. Yeah. I when I first saw the trailer, I told myself I am going to lower my expectations as far as humanly possible. And then
Rotten Tomatoes raised them up for you.
Oh my gosh, it was awful.
Which was kind of like, is everyone having fun with this? Because it's so bad, let's rate it 100%. Or why not?
You know, it's funny. Rotten Tomatoes is pretty predictable. It's pretty consistent, I don't know. I was just worried because it was like, you know, I figured I would enjoy it. I just didn't know what I was going to enjoy about it. You know what was going to happen, but it brought my expectations back up. And then I thought I thought they hit it out of the park. And there were a couple of points.
Really?
There were a couple points where I thought they were really going off the rails a little bit, and then they brought it back, and it was just like they get right up to the cusp. You're like, oh, that's brilliant. That was great storytelling. That was great storytelling.
Hey, Jesse, just want to let you know that Matthew can confirm that the Lego Movie is amazing. It's an 11 out of 10.
Yeah,
you need to go see it.
Especially if you're a Lego fan at all. If you're a fan. Both of us are. Obviously, I have a Lego rocket ship on, you know, the space shuttle, commemorative space shuttle on my desk because I'm a huge Lego fan. So this is just like.
So was that scene where Batman's trying to throw the batarangs and it keeps missing and then he finally hits it and goes, first try.
For sure.
Is that just as funny as it was in the trailer?
It is just as funny as it is in the trailer, except I've seen the trailer like 8 times. So like as it's happening, you know it's happening. But the best part about it is that type of humor is pretty persistent and well delivered throughout the entire movie. And the cameos are fantastic because they get all the Lego parts in there and just the different voice actors they got for the parts. It's just
reading an article, which I didn't link to, so you guys are out of luck, they were talking about how just Nintendo is killing it, and how they were, I mean, I don't remember the exact dates, Lego, but there was a point in time where they were on track to go bankrupt, like we were going to say goodbye to Lego, and it was going to be super sad, and everyone was going to cry, and they had a leadership change.
As it were.
Which, by the way, this is foreshadowing, if you will. They had a leadership change. not for Palm, for something else. And not Palm, oh my gosh, Palm. BlackBerry. That was a slip. Anyways,
yeah,
he came in and essentially told the company, we need to simplify way down. And, you know, so they got rid of, they sold off their parks, you know, they kept the names that are no longer actually run by Lego. They totally simplified down the amount of Lego pieces that they had.
This is the amazing part to me, is they went from, it was something crazy, like 4,000 different pieces down to like 1,000. It wasn't like they scaled it back a little. They went through an unbelievable dramatic reduction in different pieces. And now adding new pieces is like a painstaking process in the company.
And what's interesting is, I mean, so it reduced your manufacturing costs. Yeah. And then they did get into the, like, okay, we're going to buy IP and do specific Lego sets. And Star Wars was the one that put them back on the path to glory.
Yeah.
And they figured out that formula. So they went, okay, we got it. And then they got on, you know, Harry Potter and the Marvel Comics.
And one of the things that I really like is that all of this, you know, a lot of their IP is owned, licensed IP is owned by other movie execs. And there were very few of their of the really star Lego sets that didn't make it into this movie. I mean, and that's what's cool about it, right? Is that it's like, it's not just the classic Lego pieces that make cameos and are really cool. It's, you know, it's Han Solo.
Yeah. And now today, the company, the Lego company, man, I wish I didn't even think to do this article, but that's okay. The Lego company today is now a bigger company than Mattel and Hasbro.
Awesome.
They're like, I mean, like I said, they're killing it. They're doing awesome. They're not going anywhere. It's fantastic.
I actually want to do more research about how they've kind of like what they've done, because one of the things that I find really interesting about the company is that, you know, I think everybody played the Star Wars games and the Star Wars Lego games, and there is – it's unquestionable.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
There have been a ton of Star Wars games made, just mountains of them. And, like, of your top five, it's pretty, like, universally accepted that X-Wing Fighter, Star Wars Battlefront, Jedi Academy, what was it, Star Wars
Force Unleashed?
Force Unleashed.
I know.
The Old Republic one. Knights of the Old Republic.
Oh, yeah,
and the Lego Star Wars games are like the five greatest Star Wars games ever made. And you know, and it's just like, how did the Legos... And one of the things that they did was that it was the comedic approach to it. It was the, you know, it was just the goofiness of it. And so now that they're doing the Marvel thing, the Marvel video games are getting great reviews. The Indiana Jones one got really good reviews. They just didn't do great in sales. But you sit there and go, like, one of the things that runs through it is just this childlike sense of, like, you know, of comedy through the whole thing. And what I think is really interesting is that Lego was building their own video games during this period of almost collapsing. And one of the first things they did was license video games away. And so they gave it to, I think it's TT, so I know that's their initials. I can't remember what the name of the company is. And that company has subsequently relicensed making video games to other studios. So it's like there's many studios building all of these games that are Lego games, and but there's obviously this theme, which means somebody somewhere along the lines is controlling the, you know, the image of Lego video games. And a lot of those themes that are funny and the comedic sense of timing that makes those games great were also present in the movies. And it's hard to believe that that's a coincidence, that just everybody would say, hey, that's a really good idea, let's make a game that's funny and cool, which leads me to believe that somebody somewhere along the lines, probably at the Lego company, is calling the shots, saying, no, it's got to be this type of thing.
And I'm going to imagine they tried different styles, and you can't do serious drama. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense.
I mean,
plastic pieces.
Oh my god!
You know what else is really interesting about them is, you know, just to continue the Lego love for a little bit here, is it's been really fun to watch them identify markets and go after it, right? So right, they get the Star Wars fans, they get the Harry Potter fans, they do the space theme thing, and then we've seen it where they do those what I would call a mega model. You know, just yeah. those really big, complex ones that cost hundreds of dollars to buy, which I love, and so do you. And then they've realized that all these kids who grew up with Legos are now young adults, and you've seen those, you know, I don't, what do they call them? They're like the micro models, or the ones that go on your desk. Yeah. They're usually all one color,
like
very slick.
The architectural ones, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You're like, oh, that's awesome. And just 2 weeks ago, I was over at a friend's house, and I saw for the first time, and I just smiled because they're going to do it all over again. It wasn't Barbie, but it was Dollhouse. So all the pieces were pastels and a ton of pink. And this girl who was showing it to me, she essentially bought a Dollhouse that she built herself. Yeah. And then all the little dolls and stuff could, you know, or the Lego figurines, whatever, not dolls.
Say the chick market has been one of the hardest things that is so dismissive.
Yeah,
the female market has been one of the hardest things for Lego to one of the hardest markets for Lego to crack. And
yeah.
It's funny. It's, you know, this is like George R. R. Martin, the dude who wrote Game of Thrones and that entire series, A Song of Fire and Ice. A lot of people have asked him, you know, that you write some of the best female characters of any writer, especially in fiction. Like, how do you do that? Where do you find all this inspiration from? And he goes, I do one thing. I just remember their people. And
nice.
Wow. Okay. And it's funny when you read it, all they're doing is rational things, defending their priorities and their families. And you're like, yeah, that makes sense. And they're just capable, strong human beings that happen to be the females of the family. And Lego finally has gotten their head on straight, where all of, you know, for the longest time, it was like the Duplo for little kids, you know, girl Legos were like not real Legos. They weren't interchangeable with Legos. And finally they've gotten their head on straight where they're like building real Lego sets, like you said. They're just pink. They're a color palette that girls like.
Yeah.
You know, but other than that, they're still the complex, they're interchangeable parts. They're still Lego. And that's what, you know, girls have really similar brains to boys, just it's a color palette thing that they want that's different. And
they're really smart. Their next step is gonna be to partner up with Disney and create Frozen I would actually consider this one Cinderella Castle.
Oh, man.
Sleeping Beauty's Castle. You know what I mean? And just like
– I would get a
Beast. And then maybe not right away, but have that be one of the $200 castles that actually is like 2 feet in the air. You're just like, oh,
yeah.
That's
oh,
awesome.
Dude. Oh, my gosh. The Disney Castle.
Yes, right? Which, by the way, Jesse and I are doing a Lego – or not a Lego, a puzzle, which is like a Lego, I guess, in 2D, it's a Thomas Kinkade painting of the Disney World castle. Since we're snowed in, not going anywhere, we're like, puzzle time.
I would be down to throw in, I don't know if you know, especially with our family, man, there are people that would drop big money on a 5,000 piece, you know, Cinderella's Disney World castle.
Sweet.
Just a gigantic one. Oh, my gosh. And he just like, and, you know, it's not necessarily what I would buy, but I could see a lot of people buy one. And, you know, and it's.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, and right. It's targeting the market just right, right? I'm not going to buy one of the Dollhouse things, but
right.
I look at it and go, dude, but I know who would, and they would absolutely love it. But,
right.
Yeah, so.
You know what,
I'll be honest. Not only does this make me want to go watch the movie, but it does make me want to go out and buy some Legos, which is
exactly
what they want.
I want some Legos. My favorite quote. My favorite quote from any review. I'm gonna have to. I'm going from memory, so let me. It was. I've never watched a movie that tried harder to not sell me a product that made me only want to run out and buy their product. I've never seen a movie that tried harder to not sell me a product that made me want to buy their product more after the movie was done. And it's so true. It's so true. You do not feel like you're being – and the cinematography of the movie is brilliant in a lot of ways. I was blown away by some of it. And just brilliant and, like, beautiful in capturing the essence of Lego. They have this the last thought I wanted to make, and this is where Transformers I think failed horribly, but Lego did brilliantly. When they built all their cool models for the movie, they're real models made out of real Legos. So when you buy the sets,
really?
from the movie,
that's brilliant.
They're the actual sets from the movie. They're part for part recreations. And you're like, there's no reason not to be able to do that.
That's really smart.
And you say, it drives me nuts that in the Transformer movies, they could have made these really accurate models where you build up these, like, that they're Transformers, a simplified version that for, like, your cheap $20 toys that the 10-year-olds are going to buy, but then, you know, because the movies are going to be, like, more complicated and everything, but if you were to make them accurate, where you could actually make an action figure out of them, you could have easily sold $150 Optimus Prime to me. But they decided to not go that rad, and that sort of thing, just like, I don't want one. I'm not interested in that. I want something that you had here, and you turned me off to it. I want something, you know, really intriguing, but the fact that the Lego move, I'm just like, oh my gosh, I want all of them. I want all of them so bad. So you know what though? We are not here this week to talk about Legos, although it is one of my favorite companies.
15 minutes later,
I could talk about the Lego company for so long, and I wish they spoke English. Otherwise, I would make it my life's goal to work for them. Because I like America.
They just have 3D printers everywhere, man. There was a really cool Lifehacker article. It was a few years ago that they went and did a trip there and walked through and interviewed them and talked about it. It was super cool. And yeah, it totally makes you want to go work there when you're done. But
this week, like every week, we are here to talk about technology and the continuing corporate opera. This one's a good one.
And shockingly, news.
I know. And when we talk about the corporate opera, what we're actually talking about is the soap opera of corporations dealing back and forth, the people working for them, which is quite important today, their marketing campaigns, and, of course, the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James has got a short disclosure.
I work for HP, but do not represent HP or any of HP's opinions or the opinions of their partners.
Perfect. If you want to follow us throughout the week.
Like, say, Microsoft.
Right, exactly. if you want to follow us throughout the week, see pictures of, you know, me going to concerts super late at night or hear tweets about me going to the Lego movie. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Matthew D. Furlow. My Instagram is NextWiggin4. That's 2 G's in Wiggin, like Ender.
I am at James Furlow and jamesfurlow.com.
All right. And if you want to see all the clicks and links and videos from this week's show, unless we didn't link them, James.
Like our first 15 minutes.
Exactly. You can go to furloughbros.com. There we have the podcast link if you're coming from YouTube, including show cuts. So if you don't want the whole thing, you just want little bite-sized pieces, you can get that feed as well. If you're listening from the podcast, go there and get the YouTube link if you want to be able to watch this live and see all of our hand gestures. It should be
or
fun.
Or head nods.
Yeah, exactly. Anytime we're giving subtle body language and forget that we're talking to you and not having you watch us.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Also, you can contact us there, comment and stuff. It's cool. Check it out. I think you're up.
Question.
First. What do these things all have in common?
Have you downloaded and played the game Flappy Bird?
Of course. Everybody has.
Have you?
Yeah. I've gotten one point.
Okay, good. Well, so what's interesting is I was going to talk about it and the success of it, But it doesn't matter anymore because the developer this morning removed it from the App Store. So, yeah.
And what I think
apparently he got tired of people harassing him, which from the sounds of the game, it sounds like it's impossible, as your score suggested. And people, for some reason, loved to hate it. So,
yeah, but he was making tons and tons and tons.
Yeah, they were saying that he was making $50,000 a day in revenue from in-app ads, which I would have been like, yeah, you know what? People are harassing me. For that amount of money, I can hire someone to take it all and then just give me, you know, the important stuff. Or,
yeah, it's
the praise or like forward my actual emails to me, however you want to think about that.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, one of the things that I do think is interesting here is I think a lot of people yesterday were saying, well, this is obviously a big marketing ploy. You set it out on Twitter. I'm going to take it down from the App Store. I'm in the 11th hour or the 22nd hour in this case. At the very end of the time, he has a change of heart and thinks, you know, so many people downloaded the app that I'm going to keep it on the store. And everybody goes out because you've only got 22 hours to get the hottest game in the App Store. And everybody was like, obviously this is a brilliant marketing ploy, because you're going to go out and if you had any thought of downloading it, you're going to go and download it and play it at least once, because
so my plan was to not download it and then have hope that you hadn't played it and then have you try just to watch you get frustrated live, but that plan backfired on me. But
yeah
well, interesting. I don't know, maybe he hit his number where he was like, all right, I'm good, I can retire, I don't need to put up with this anymore. And they say if you still download it, you can still play it, which means he's still going to get the revenue. So I'm sure it will go down, but I wouldn't be shocked if he's still making $40,000 to $30,000 a day for the next couple months. And
right,
retirement money.
I think it would be interesting, and I hope somebody gets to the bottom of why he pulled it. Because I think, obviously it wasn't a
total. Well, if anything, as the game shows you, is, if the game show teaches you anything, is that he hates people and he loves to drive them nuts. And so he is consistent on that level.
Yeah, you know what? That is a good point.
So there you go. So, but that actually, honestly, was, so we're going to skip that one as much as it is. And I'd rather talk about something that will hopefully come to pass. I saw this friend posted it on Facebook this month. And from what I understand, this thing's actually been around for a couple years, but they keep getting closer and closer to it. It is an air-powered car. Crazy, all right? It actually, it puts air pressure, pressurizes air, and then you drive it around. It's got a range of about 100 miles, and it costs about $1 per tank of air because you've got to, put it together. They're like, but if you actually got to pump, suck it in from the outside. Like, but if you had a windmill that could power the air compressor, they're like, it'd be free. Essentially.
Right.
So, of course, it's a concept car, so it looks a little crazy, in the sense that it's got three wheels and it's got two joysticks in the front. And so, it's not your classic car, even though they do have a bigger version of it. And the other cool part about this that I love is that they're going to sell this bad boy for $10,000.
Wow.
Seems a little low, right?
Yeah, I was going to say that's remarkably affordable.
Yeah, so they've got a whole bunch of, third world countries, essentially. India, South America are super into it. There's a part of me, though, that's like, that's neat, but why not charge $15,000 or $20,000, get some real funding going, and that way you can actually, do something very cool. Think Tesla, right, where it doesn't cost – well, it probably does. It doesn't cost them – or I should say, their margins are fantastic, which allows them to do the development for further vehicles, to do some very interesting things. And because of your gas savings and whatever, they can still rationalize it out. I look at this one, $1 per tank, that's pretty darn awesome. And, I think people would be willing to spend $20,000 on this little gizmo thing.
I'm surprised that they're not trying to compete with golf carts. You know, and just looking at the size of it, they're obviously pretty small and stuff, but they're, you know, they seem that my first reaction just looking at them is they look like golf carts, you know, fully covered and stuff.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's something that I don't understand that would explain why they're not really compatible with golf carts, you know, whether they don't have the power or if they are, you know, or golf carts are just, you know, more efficient. But golf carts are expensive. It's not like they're super affordable.
Yeah, that's true. They're like $5,000.
Right. So, you know, I wonder why. I wonder what the compelling reason is there.
Yeah, I don't know.
Or maybe there's just no
it's
cost
called an AirPod.
Yeah, I don't know. It's called an AirPod, and it still might be a while, because like I said, they've been talking about it for a couple years, but it's just starting to reach that tipping point where they're like, all right, we're going to start selling these things. We're actually going to start manufacturing them.
That's cool.
Pretty cool. So I'm just keeping you all on the forefront of technology.
Perfect.
Here it comes. Be ready.
Cool. Very cool. All right. So this is also a technology that is coming, and more I'm being completely sold on the fact that I'm going to have to buy one of these, and so I'm going to have to figure out how to afford it. But basically, so the last couple of weeks we've talked about some gaming stuff that I thought was really cool. Last week we talked about the destruction of $200,000 worth of digital stuff in the game Eve Online. A couple weeks before that, we talked about we talked about the Oculus Rift at CES, and they were demonstrating an in-cockpit game, like a game where you're like in the cockpit, you could see all sorts of stuff, and it was doing head tracking. Well, that game that they were demoing was Eve Online Valkyrie, or Eve Valkyrie as they're calling it, and basically, which, you know, like it looked really cool. Everybody said it was amazing. But there wasn't, it was more of a demo. Well, Oculus has officially announced that they will be co-publishing Eve Valkyrie, but rebuilt specifically for the Oculus.
Cool.
And yeah, that makes me want that really, really, really bad.
So you're essentially like a in cockpit flying around.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I just, you know, it's funny. I mean, like, it's the sort of thing that it's like, this is what I want. These are the kind of things that it's like, you know, if you're just, it's got high enough graphics ability to make Eve look really good. Giant space sim, you know, and so if all you're doing is going flying around space with 3D, you know, goggles on, and, you know, and like fully immersive sound and everything, so you can look around and play, and you're doing it from like inside the cockpit of your spaceship, and you're going around and like mining stuff and doing things, and all of a sudden you're in the middle of like a space battle. I don't even know how to articulate how excited I am about this sort of a thing. Like, this is amazing. This is really, 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 really cool. It's just, oh man, I'm so excited. I talked to guys of, you know, so obviously I work in the semiconductor industry in the Silicon Valley. So I have guys that have been deeply entrenched in technology, and being right on the cutting edge for the last 30 years. I work for guys like that. I partner with guys like that, and you hear all their stories, and they always talk about how it's just amazing what happens every 10 years. I mean, it's just like the world is completely different every 10 years, and it's impossible to imagine what it'll be like in 20 years. You can't. And it just moves too fast. But I sit there and I go, like, and this is a perfect example. Like, thinking back to video games I played, like, in the middle of high school compared to this, it's just a completely different ballpark. It's a completely different league of games.
Right.
And of a virtual experience. And, oh, dude, it's just so exciting. So I'm pretty optimistic. And this, and it's funny. This is the other thing. Oculus Rift needs something more than just being super impressive technology. There's a lot of consoles that have been really super impressive. What they need is titles that sell the system. They need content. And, you know, and that's one of the things that that guy that they hired, John, it's not John Cusack, that's somebody completely different. The guy from id Software, he left id, and because he went to his bosses and basically said, look, I want to build VR games. And they said, it's not going to happen. And he said, okay, I quit. And joined the Oculus team as the chief technology officer. And the fact that he's gone there, you know, a really high-powered game developer who has a deep passion for VR, tells me that not just EVE Valkyrie is going to be this, but there's going to be more and more games that are going to be really dedicated to this type of thing. And I think you're going to see very quickly that there will be games that are just a completely different ballpark because they're on the Oculus. And so I'm really excited, and I can't wait, and I want one real bad. So my thought here is I got to figure out time frames and costs so I can start to figure out what that actually means for me. But that's cool.
Yeah, that is very cool. I will admit that I would not mind having one either.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, James. Right now, once I get one and you come and visit, I will let you play as long as you want.
You'll let me watch you play?
Yeah, exactly. Wow, that headset sure looks like a headset.
Wow, that's so amazing. I bet that feels great.
Yeah, it does. You should totally try it next time you come.
You should get one. It's great.
I understand. Dude, we totally used to do that. Remember, like, friends would come over, they'd start playing the game, and they'd be like, well, you're doing it wrong. Here, let me show you. Before you knew it, we were playing the game, and our friends were off doing something else. We were those people.
Yeah. Well, in our defense, I think that was pretty common for all kids did that at some point, I think. Everybody has a similar memory of that. I hope.
Let's hope. Don't know, but let's hope. That's funny. That's funny. Cool. All right, is it time?
I guess it's time, dude. Do I get to? Right. Oh, my name's on the top one. I get to break this news. Okay, everybody.
You did it
brace
first.
Yourselves. Oh, wait a second. So I tried to remember how to pronounce his name, but I don't.
Satya Nadella.
Okay, we're going to go with Satya. So, Microsoft obviously has been in turmoil since the company's completely collapsing. They've got all the wrong momentum. Their sales have been terrible. They're losing money hand over fist. Actually, very little of that is true. They pretty much have just been staying the course, which has been driving their investors crazy. Because what they're seeing is Facebook, Google, and Apple, and Samsung, and Lenovo, and other companies like that who aren't just staying the course at having explosive, unbelievable growth. And the investors are like, what's up, Microsoft? What's going on? Why aren't you doing that? It's called into question basically the entire leadership of the company. Obviously, Steve Ballmer announced he was going to step down. And Gates has gotten some guff as being the chairman of the board. One of the big reason more than anything that it's justified that, you know, maybe he shouldn't be the chairman of the board is he's funding the Gates Institute by selling his stock. And as time goes on, he has a smaller and smaller stake in the company. And at some point it doesn't make sense for him to be the chairman of the board because he's not the, you know, he's not a big enough stakeholder. He's spending more and more time there. But there's also a question of, you know, you're the chairman of the board. What's going on with the company? Like, you know, why isn't the company going to this growth? Do you care? Probably. He probably cares. Steve Ballmer steps down and they go through this, like, long process to find a new CEO for the company. And as of Tuesday, they finally announced that How do you say his name?
Satya.
Satya. I can't. Every time I look at it, I blank because it's Satya.
Thankfully I listened to a video when someone else said it. I went, oh, okay, because I kept thinking like Satya.
Yeah.
Like no, it's a soft A.
Yeah.
He is Indian. Yeah. If that helps, probably not.
Yeah, well, it does help, I think. But he, yeah. So he's been named as the new CEO of Microsoft. So
yeah.
Bottom line it for me, James. Good thing or bad thing?
That is the question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Depends. Really, I don't know enough about him. There are a couple good things, a couple bad things about him.
One of the articles I read
that I would probably never be able to find mentioned it. So, like, for example, he came out of the server division.
Yeah. Okay? So for starters, he is a 22-year alumnus, but.
Veteran.
Thank you. Veteran of Microsoft.
He's a lifer.
Yeah. He's been there.
Yeah.
He was
so,
like 23.
Which I would actually say is a knock against him. That's just me. where if you want to bring in new thinking, clearly he's not new. Though he'll definitely run it like his own style eventually. So that's against him. Some good that's going for him, again, is he's from the server group and he's got experience there. I actually was reading this. I saw this really cool article that was saying that with his appointment, now the search CEOs run Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft because, obviously Larry Page knows a little bit about search and is running Google. Marissa Mayer knows a little bit about search and is running Yahoo. And I didn't know this until I read this, but before Satya was put in charge of the servers, he was put in charge of MSN Live and then changed it over to Bing before leaving that group.
Which, as much fun as it is to knock Bing, let's all remember that Bing not only is, Yahoo and Bing take up second and third place for most returned results, but Bing powers all of Yahoo's search results. So in reality, Bing is a far second to Google, but Google's got like 60% of all searches and Bing's got like 20. It's which, when you're talking about an incumbent, the quality and size of Google, that's an astounding achievement. I never use Bing, but I know a lot of people that use Bing for certain specific tasks that they like, and they sit there and they go, yeah, it's way better than Google for whatever. And there are countries where Bing is the favorite, and by a good margin.
Go ahead.
I guess my point with Bing is that is just to bring that all up is that it's a good product, and I think it's had a lot more success. It is a lot more successful than pop culture gives it credit for. And when you actually look at the numbers, what it's done versus what you should expect it to do, it wasn't gonna knock Google off of the king, off of being king of the hill. And it's taken a lot more ground from Google than I think a lot of people expected it to, in reality. Obviously, they hoped that it would completely crush Google, but, so, okay.
Yeah, and I think that, just straight up searching on the web is not that important. But as we move further down this post-PC era, and more importantly, move away from classical file structures, I think search on devices and on servers, wherever, are going to become immensely important. And, so to have a guy who at least gets that, he's obviously not going to be the one implementing it, but the one who goes, no, let's just search for it. It's okay. I think having a guy who gets that will be critically important.
Right. And when you think about,
whatever it is they're making.
Right. And when you think about unconventional, like, you know, technologies working together, much the same way that you know, Microsoft's our Windows Phone 7, Windows Phone 8's keyboard, the Windows Phone's keyboard is like this critically acclaimed keyboard, and a lot of that credit is given to the fact that they have such an immense history of autocorrect. That's like, they just, that's a huge strength of Microsoft, and they lent that computer science to the autocorrect on the keyboard, effectively all it was, and that built a really, really robust, reliable keyboard. Where that cross, you know, strength is something that I think long term is, you know, Google's ability to look at phrases and searches and just take anything and turn it into, we understand what you're asking as you're asking it and give you the most relevant information for that, is going to long term, you know, turn their Google Assistant, their Android Assistant, their Siri competitor, that's going to turn out even more powerful than Siri ever could be. Just the nature of what the company's core competencies are, you know, they're, like they've said, you know, before, they're trying to build the computer from Star Trek. And I think long term, you're going to watch Apple Siri move that direction as well, and they're probably going to buy somebody in order to make up lost ground on that, yeah, on that competency. And the fact that, you know, that Satya has that background and that comprehension means that as Google continues to push that computer science forward over the next, you know, decade and really make some huge progress, he's going to understand what they're doing, and when people come to him and say, hey, this is what we need to get great at too, he's going to say, okay, let's do it. And you'll see, you know, you'll see that. And I'm a fan of the idea that I think that, you know, a single interface that you can either type into or talk into in order to, you know, give you a central control of your computer and your phone is going to be more and more and more important. And I think, you know, he's going to be more equipped for that than somebody who's, you know, great at building Xboxes.
Mm. Yeah, I'm with you there. There was in an article they were talking about, you know, here's some of the challenges he faces, and one of the an investor, you know, analyst, those type of people. The way they said it is, he is the right person to drive safe right down the middle of the fairway and continue Microsoft's strengths. What we don't know is, will Nadella help with the consumer revival or with the mobile revival? Mobile is an open hole in his background. So you're right, that is one strength, but another weakness of his is the mobile space, just because he doesn't have any experience there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you ask, is he going to be good? Is he going to be bad? I wouldn't be shocked if we find Microsoft becoming more and more of a what do you want to call it? An enterprise company, a la HP. Yeah. And you know, that's where his strengths are. That's what he's comfortable with. Clearly, he believes in it. But do you think that he'll be able to, you know, not knowing him or his thoughts?
It's funny. You know, I'm shooting from the gut here. I'm absolutely shooting from the gut.
That's
here.
All we got.
I'm spitballing. But my instinct is going to be this. I don't think they're going to make up a lot of ground in China with their mobile stuff because of his leadership. But I think they are going to see growth and continued growth with that market, because I think they're going to do better in India than anybody's going to expect. They're already doing better in India with their Nokia purchase. And the fact that he's actually was born Indian and, you know, came to America, you know, so he's a naturalized immigrant, you know, yeah, means that he has a cultural background that guys like Tim Cook has to hire somebody to hey, tell me what to do in India. Whereas,
yeah,
you know, Satya has got family there, has got history there, grew up there.
It's true.
And obviously he spent long enough here where it's not, you know, he doesn't have a super connection to it. But my gut would be, if you came to him with two products and said, which one of these is going to sell better in India, he, of all of the CEOs, you know, Larry Page, Tim Cook, and him, he's going to be the one who says that one. Probably that one. You know, and that one's going to do
that's
better.
True.
You know, and so it's like,
that's,
you know,
true.
And I mean that's
and you
just,
could win India and do just fine.
Yep. Yeah. And India is a huge open playbook. Apple's spending tons of money to try to not lose India right now because they've basically ceded that territory, China, in large measure. You know, they're okay playing only in the, you know, only in the super rich parts of China. They're A-okay with that. They've decided that that's what they're going to do. And, you know, they want to have it on every carrier, and they just wanted that. They want that top 3% of Chinese who can afford it. And they'll take their margins and they'll walk away and be happy. But in India, it's a completely different ballpark. There's actually places for them to go and things to do. And it's like I was reading an article probably this week where they've restarted manufacturing of the 4S's specifically for India because they're affordable in India. So it's and the Nokia, the low-end Nokia phones are doing great in India. Most of their growth is in India. And so I think that there's a real market there for mobile. And if you could get a foothold somewhere to justify the department, you know, even if it's not America, eventually you can grow to other places. You know, you just need a stronghold. And America has a stronghold in America, or America. Apple has a stronghold in America.
America does have a stronghold in America.
Yes. Nice job, guys. Teamwork.
Nailed it.
Android obviously has one in China. If you could take India, that would be huge. But there's a bigger, broader question of, you know, building consumer goods and stuff. Yeah, can he do that? I don't know. If you've listened to this show, you know my opinion of Microsoft is that there are some incredible computer scientists and engineers there. It's not like it's a complete brain drain like BlackBerry.
No.
The great ideas have a very hard time rising to the top, and have in the last 10 years, I think. And there's been some stifling stuff that's just been that Steve Ballmer is, you know, blamed for. One of the big things is their employee ranking system, where it's a zero sum game. If you're not the best, or if you're not better than, you know, if somebody's better than you, you're graded poorly against it. Even if you're both great, if that guy's greater than you, you're in trouble. And it made for a very, you know, contentious, you know, backbiting area.
Yeah.
But even beyond that, you know, Ballmer liked to pit the different departments against each other, so they actively worked to against each other. And there were evidence of, like, music services that would work on some Microsoft devices but not on others, because one department there's one department that they're friends with, another that they're competing with, so they would support it for the departments that they're friends with and not for, you know, the Xbox division. And you're just like, what the heck is this business? Yeah. And so I sit there and I go, you know, yeah, it'd be really good for him to have an understanding of, you know, of mobile, but what's really the most important thing, in my opinion, is that unlike Ballmer, he can get the guys who and girls who really understand the best technology and build the best products and get them building the best products and technology. You know, Tim Cook's job isn't to build the best iPhone. His job is to make sure that Johnny Ives is happy, and if he needs a coffee, go get him a coffee. If Sasha can do that, if he can find a Johnny Ives and make sure his coffee's always warm, I think that he will have success where other people, you know, don't, he's smart. And that's the one thing that I think is, like, really, really clear from the little bit of bio that I get.
Smart.
Yeah, he's crazy smart and scary. No wonder I'll never be, you know, a successful CEO because of, you know, a multi-billion-dollar company, because you got to be like that guy. He's really smart, and he learns like crazy too. And he's relatively young. That's the other thing. You know.
Well, yeah, 46, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I mean, you say you got to be really smart. I don't know what the size of Ford was when Henry finally left, but, you know, his famous quote, you know, they asked his success, or how did it go? when, you know, they were interviewing him, they, you know, some journalist or whatever, were interviewing him to try to figure out, like, all right, how smart is this guy? And so they'd ask him some question, and Henry Ford would go, yeah, I don't know. Let me get my, you know, manufacturing guy in here. And he'd ask him, hey, how much is blah, blah, blah? And, you know, that person would give the answer. And he goes, okay, there's your answer. And then he'd ask him another question about, like, tires. You go, all right, well, let me get my tire guy in here. And then he'd ask him, hey, what is this answer about tires? And that person would give the answer. And he'd go, okay, there it is. And they're like, this journalist takeaway was like, dude, Henry Ford's not very smart at all. He doesn't know anything going on with his company. He's an idiot. And Henry Ford's quote was like, no, I am successful because I have learned how I have learned to surround myself with individuals who are smarter than I am.
Right.
And, you know, and to which you're like, oh, wow, Henry Ford's really smart.
Yeah.
Or, you know, yeah. At least self-aware and understood what it took to be successful. It's not about him. It's about the team and,
yeah.
You know, and the people underneath, letting them, you know, freeing them up to do what they do. And I think, and eventually I will, you know, yeah, anyways, I think that, you know, part of the job is to do that, is to find and to attract and retain really, really smart people. And so he runs the risk of being one of those smart people. But you know what? You look at the Google CEOs, clearly they're not idiots. They're crazy smart.
I guess my point was, in saying that, is that when people say, you know, he doesn't have a background in smartphones, it's like, hey, have you met this guy? The only reason he doesn't have a background in smartphone operating systems is because he hasn't spent a year doing it. Give him 20 minutes.
Yeah.
He'll catch
up. He hasn't had to.
Right, yeah. I don't fear for his ability to understand and, you know, and see the course forward. It's all about his leadership. Is he a good leader, you know?
Well, so that's what I was about to say is you know, all of that's important, but the most important aspect of it is leadership. And I was reading an article by John Gruber, who is an Apple fanboy through and through.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which is why it's always interesting to hear his, you know, opinions about Microsoft. And but one of the points that he brought up was to be able to create a vision for people to follow.
Yeah.
You know, and he goes, that's super important. So this is a little long, but I'm going to read it anyways because I thought it was really good. Is, you know, so he was talking about how, what's his face? Bill Gates, who we will talk about in a little bit here, a little bit more. You know, he had a vision of, right, it was a computer on every desk in every home or something like that. And then it was like dot, dot, dot. Running Windows.
Yeah.
Essentially, you know, that was their internal one. And then he talked about, and then he got into the thing of, you know, with the smartphones. And what I thought was really interesting is here, let me see, I think I'll pick this up in the right way, was, you know, talking about how they struggled with it. He says, what they missed was the next step from every desk and home, a computer in every pocket. He goes, it's worse than that, though. They saw it coming, and they tried. Pocket PC, Windows CE, Windows Mobile, swings and misses at the next big thing. They weren't even close. Steve Ballmer didn't even – oh, and even worse, Steve Ballmer didn't even seem to realize it. That's what's so bad about that video of him laughing at the original iPhone. Whenever I dredge up that video, a handful of defenders will all write to tell me it's unfair to mock him for his reaction, and that he was actually right. The original iPhone was too expensive. But what should have scared Microsoft wasn't that the iPhone wasn't what the iPhone was in 2007. It was what the iPhone clearly was going to be in 2008, 2009, 2010. Prices come down, chips get faster, software evolves. Apple had unveiled to the world a personal computer that fit in your pocket. That was amazing. That the original iPhone left so much room for improvement is simply the way revolutionary products always get their start. Microsoft's institutional lack of taste, again, he's biased, had finally come to bite them in the butt. While Ballmer laughed at the iPhone and presumably walked around with a Windows Mobile piece of junk in his pocket, Larry Page and Sergey Brin carried iPhones. Google never laughed at the iPhone. It made money from it by providing web search and maps. Google quickly became, and remains to this day, a leading developer of iOS apps.
Sure.
It was Google that was fast to follow the iPhone with Android, slurping up the commodity market crumbs that Apple, focused as ever on the quality-minded high end of the market, eschewed. Now, I don't think it was ever within Microsoft's DNA to produce the iPhone, but what Android became, the successful fast follower, could have been theirs if they'd recognized their opportunity faster. Now, this is what's interesting. The Microsoft of 1984, a decade away from industry dominance, wrote software for the original Mac and learned from it. When Bill Gates first saw a Mac, he didn't laugh. He wanted to know how it worked, right down to the specific details, like the smooth animation of its mouse cursor. You're just like, ooh, that's, I mean, it's really, you know, he's making fun of Steve Ballmer. And so he goes, so Satya Nadella needs to find Microsoft's new, a computer on every desk in every home running Microsoft software. Here's my stab at it. Microsoft services, sending data to and from every networked device in the world. The next ubiquity isn't running on every device, it's talking to every device. So that was super long, but the point being, you know, again, talking about the mobile and leadership is he.
You have to save that article. You know, sometimes, you know, sometimes you like you read stuff and you're just like, yeah, yeah, you just, that was articulated just about perfectly. And you wonder, have you had that knocking around in your head for like a decade and just have never bothered to say that out loud before? Because I read a lot of John Gruber and he's never said anything like that before. Or was this just one of those moments of brilliance where it just sort of all coalesced at the right moment, the right triggers went off in his brain? Because that's, I mean, that sums it up so perfectly, the difference in the reactions. I mean, and you know, and they talk about Google from head to toe, you know, not just Larry and Sergey walking around with iPhones, but, you know, but to the very core of the leader of the Android team during the keynote had, you know, we talked about that story a month or two ago where he was driving to talk with manufacturers about the earliest forms of Android. He's in his limo and he had the guy pull over so he could finish watching the keynote and realize that I can't go talk with these guys. We have to rebuild Android, you know, and when you contrast that against, you know, Microsoft's, you know, response and even like you said, and even more crazily against, you know, Steve Gates or Bill Gates, not Steve Gates,
Bill
Gates, you know, reaction, to, you know, to the Mac, you know, and obviously that's a little bit different, but at the same time, it's pretty similar, you know, and it's funny. I mean, and it's, you know, a computer in every pocket is a big one, but there's other ones out there, you know, like they clearly the iWatch is coming, you know, a watch is coming and it may not be Apple. Like, you know, they're going the health route. That's clearly what they're doing. You know, they want to make the best health device out there, but you know, I think anybody who's ever thought about watch technology in general, you realize you go from giant clocks that are one for the entire city to grandfather clocks that don't move but are like large, you know, centerpiece of the house to desktop clocks to pocket watches to wristwatches. They kept getting smaller, and finally the wristwatch was the personal watch that everybody, the personal thing that everybody went with. What does the interface look like? How does it work? What does it do? I don't know. I can't answer that question. Very few people can. But clearly,
that's I think
the
I'm
same
like you.
Trend. Yeah, what?
Well, yeah, and I actually don't know if that's the right one, because the iPhone is not a phone. It's a computer.
Right.
And so it went from, you know, this is a mainframe that is in your entire room, can't take it anywhere, to eventually, you know, a desktop that you got to have plugged in to a laptop, and now, you know, and now it's a phone, and, you know, the size, now it's the size of a phone, I should say.
Right.
And sure, it's got phone capabilities in it. And, you know, and I look at it and go, and the next one is going to be the size of a watch, the size of a pair of glasses. Who knows? The size of, something that's even more personal. So, but I think both of them, together, just go, it totally makes sense. But the question is, and we just don't know, is he the guy who's going to be able to look at something like that and instead of laughing it off, go, ooh, that's pretty cool. Let's study it. Let's get to know it. Let's become friends. And let's get close to our enemies.
And what's even more interesting, and the really the biggest question I think you have to ask is he the type of guy who won't just look at competitors and say, we can do what they're doing and do it better, but is he going to listen to guys in his own company, the brilliant guys in his own company who say, hey, this is a cool idea I had. You mind if I spend, you know, a couple minutes working on it this week? And is he going to go, yes, please, you know, or is he going to go, you know, does he have that vision? Those are the two big questions. Can he get the, attract and get smart guys? And can he sense things, and does he get excited about the future? And, you know, just reading about him and seeing what he's done with the company, I got a feeling he does. I have a feeling that he's got enough of it where you'll see Microsoft doing well in the next couple of years. You know, it might take a few. Yeah,
it might take a few years. And so this is where it also gets a little interesting here, and so I want to wrap back to this. So there's a new technology advisor.
Yeah. So, yeah, because Mr. Gates told everybody, hey, you know what? I agree. I shouldn't be the chairman of the board. It doesn't make sense anymore. I want to realign my priorities in the company. So as he takes less time being the chairman of the board, because just his position doesn't really, you know, where he's at, it doesn't really make sense, but he still wants to be, you know, intimately involved, like you said. He is moving around and going to be making technology advisory decisions.
Yeah, so it sounds like he'll just be meeting with, you know, different dev groups and hearing them out, making advice, doing what he does, which sounds kind of awesome to have that job.
I know.
Just, oh, yeah, tell me what you're working on. What if you did this? Boom, okay, I'll see you later. Go do all the work. I'm going to go blow up another team.
Right.
Sounds like fun. Sounds a lot like what Steve Jobs did at Apple, where he was meeting with the guys regularly. And so Satya's not going to be doing that as much, it sounds like. And maybe that's his way of saying, yeah, you know what, I'm not great at this part of it. And we need someone who's going to see that next big thing and say, yeah, you know what, do spend the next 2 months and develop that. Let's pursue that. That's worth pursuing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think
a little interesting with, you know, having Gates down your shoulder. I don't think Gates will ever become CEO, but, man, it sounds a little bit like a certain Apple-esque situation. Founder comes back. Oh, I'm not in charge. I'm just here to help out. I'm just an advisor.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's tough because I think Bill Gates...
It's different. I get it, but...
I think Bill Gates really actually at the, you know, it is different. And I think what's interesting about it is that, you know, and I think this is important to re-mention, you know, at this point, Bill Gates has changed the world and now he wants to save the world. Like, you know, he actually, you know, if you study his belief system, you know, he believes that he gets this little allotment time on Earth, and the difference he makes is the difference he makes, and then after that he becomes dirt, and, you know, and that affects what he does with his time in a big way. And you know,
knowing him, he probably thinks board meetings are boring and it's just something he has to do, and now he has an excuse to not do it anymore. And you know, dude, I don't care. I get to do things that are fun. I get to be on that cutting edge.
Right.
And I get to see that stuff, and that honestly is probably super exciting to him.
Right. And what I was going to say is that he is clearly and indisputably very intimately involved in the technology decisions and directions that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is going. Like, he is the advocate, the voice of their technology. Anytime somebody's got to talk about, we're building lasers that kill mosquitoes, or we're recreating how contraceptives work, or we're, you know, whatever. He's, you know, we're reimagining power systems. He is, you know, is the voice of that because he's intimately involved in it. And so it's who he is. The one big question that I think is, you know, fair to ask is that clearly, you know, he knew that the whole tablet thing was coming down the pipe. Like, he got that. He was a big advocate of
it.
He wanted tablets to happen, and he missed hard because he really believed that, you know, the stylus and the keyboard are necessary. Yeah, and
I remember watching this demo he did for, like, bus scheduling stuff.
Yeah.
You watched it? No, I would never buy – a tablet for that.
That was such a quintessential one where you're like, he had this big bulky computer and he had this pen that he could easily lose. And it's this like hundreds and hundreds of dollars computer that, yeah, you could look up bus schedules. And everybody was like, you really think people that are going to take the bus are going to be using their little, you know, laptop as they're like, as they're going around? I mean, I don't want to be prejudiced or nothing, but that, I'm being prejudiced about this one. Yeah, usually people who can afford a computer that they walk around with, the kind of people that are taking the bus all the time. Like, you know, Twitch, the world is not made up of San Franciscans that take the bus everywhere.
Yeah, and it was just a bad demo. Yeah. He should have picked a different one, but I also think that pointed to some of the problems where he didn't have a great use case in mind for it.
Exactly.
And that was one that he thought of and went, oh, this would be useful. And, you know, because he's thinking public transportation. That's the wave of the future. People aren't going to be in cars anymore. That's where his head was at. And you could tell he's from the Washington area. And it's just not the rest of the world.
Which
is
a huge thing. I mean, you know, when you think about it, like the difference between the iPad and those tablet computers was not a vast gulf, especially in general, you know, use cases. They're relatively similar. They're both computers, you know. But the big difference was is that, you know, Steve Jobs thought of it as a, you know, a large screen that you watch TVs on and you know, surf the internet and watch movies on. You know, Bill Gates looked at it as something completely different, you know, and they still want the tablet to be a productivity device. That's, you know, that's one of the big ad campaigns of Windows 8 in general.
Yeah.
Is, you know, it's for all parts of my life, not just goofing off. And, you know, as somebody who has a desktop for work and, you know, a desktop at home for work and an iPad, I don't need my iPad for work really. You know, I take notes on it maybe, you know, I show pictures. I use it kind of for work, but it's not maybe long term that's the wrong way to look at it. But the difference was is that Steve Jobs found a use case that made sense at that price point.
Yeah,
Bill Gates didn't, but there is the argument, that Gruber makes, and I completely agree with it, is that Bill Gates had a vision, and it was a vision that, you know, radically changed the world, made him the richest man who wasn't a dictator in the world, and. You know, and
they were saying when they first made that statement, they hadn't even sold BASIC yet. It was just a vision. And then when they like declared it publicly, their sales were in the tens of thousands.
Right.
And, you know, and they're like, and he's thinking billions, and they're just like, man, his brain is so far out there, which I mean, clearly he's also articulated again with his foundation on some of the stuff he wants to do. You're just like, whoa, that's crazy. So it'll be interesting to see if he applies that same type of thought. It sounds like he'll be taking a more micro level approach to it. But I wouldn't be shocked if, you know, he does contribute to some broader based vision, which I think would be great for Microsoft. Competition's awesome. I'd love to see them get after it. And, yeah.
Especially against Google. I mean, the two of them duking it out would be, you know, super fun.
Yeah.
I know. Well, it's just, it's, you know, it doesn't, like, or,
and
like,
for HP, they're partners with both. It's awesome.
Yeah. And the fun part about those two is that they're both Goliaths in their own right. And so, you know, they really could go toe to toe. But like you said, you need Bill Gates. If Satya and Bill Gates can, you know, come together on a really, you know, on a vision that really, like, can change, you know, a vision that's going to take a decade, you know, and it's funny when we talk about months ago, we talked about that article where, you know, what happened when we tried to say, let's build the technology of 10 years from now today. let's, you know, that happened twice, and you know, one of them was, oh, what was it? Was it Cisco building? You know, they tried to build computers that were going to be 100 times more powerful than the current day ones to try to develop and to ask the question. And a lot of that, like, you know, were computer science, you know, leaps and bounds happened there because they tried this crazy idea of what's the next decade going to look like. And the other one was, you know, during the you know, dot-com boom, we basically built an internet of a decade future and laid all the pathways for this explosive growth that happened. And if Bill Gates and Sasha can actually come together and say what is going to happen in the next decade, and if there are a handful of people that, you know, that can probably accurately predict what the next 10 years is going to look like on that list, Larry Page, Steve Jobs, Matthew and James Furlow, you know, Bill Gates, you know, I don't want to strain myself, pat myself on the back, but I'm going to need you to do that for me, James. I'll pat you on the back too.
No problem.
Teamwork. But you know, if they can actually do that accurately and really for the first time come up with a vision that's more than all of your entertainment on one device in one room, you know, which is like, honestly, you know, the Xbox One, it is a good improvement on the last generation of device, but it is completely unimaginative about where the gaming industry is going to be in 10 years. And there's no reason to expect that they're really pushing it forward at all. And something really disruptive, like, I don't know, the Oculus Rift, that could actually change how people play video games or other, you know, maybe the Oculus Rift is the wrong example, but there are other things out there that could completely disrupt that. And just you could watch the Xbox One be the last big selling generation. And you wonder if there's anybody at Microsoft that's really asking the question, what's gaming going to be like in 10 years? You know, what are phones going to be like in 10 years? What are pocket computers going to be like in 10 years?
Yeah.
Should we be worrying about Google Glass? Should we be worrying about smartwatches? Should we be even worrying about Windows at all? Does it make sense to have desktop computers in 10 years? And if anybody can ask those questions or answer those questions, you would hope someone like Bill Gates could. And you know, Sasha he's obviously can execute. The departments he's had you know, oversight over have done very well. And which means I think he can at least get behind visions of the future, if not come up with them himself. So I don't know. I'm hopeful for it. I like Microsoft. I hate quagmires of really great potential way more than I dislike, you know, particular policies of companies. You know, if you see products that I don't like as much as, you know, even if I'm not a, you know, I should say, like, that's to me. I may not go out and, you know, buy Microsoft, preference Microsoft stuff. May never, you know, I might always preference Google and Apple things, or it might switch all around. But as long as these companies aren't quagmired in just, whatever stupidity where you're like, there's so much potential, I'll be happy, and I want to see that will excite me. So yeah, that's my opinion.
All right, one final thing before we move on. Clearly, okay, He's not doing this for the money anymore, but it doesn't hurt to be CEO of a large company like that.
Nope.
He gets a slight raise, and I mean that when I say slight. His base salary is now $1.2 million. Good job.
That's it.
That no matter what. If he does really, really well, he could earn up to $3.6 million. And that's for the fiscal year 2015. I don't know when it starts, but he could do that. And he also did get a nice little stock award of $13.2 million. So that's nice.
Boom.
For a total of $18 million. Now, what's interesting about this is that last year, as the server and tools head, El Presidente, he earned $7.7 million. So I'm serious when it's slight from a – I mean, it's almost 100% increase, but it's – you know, he's not doing it for the money at this point. which I guess is good when you get to that level. You don't want someone doing it for the money. You need to have that higher calling and purpose.
Yeah.
Which, P.S., just a little side note. Last year, Ballmer, he received $1.26 million in total compensation, so made significantly less. Now, having said all that, he does have $333 million shares outstanding of Microsoft stock, about 4%
right.
of the company.
And, so and they were worth like $50 a share, right? Either.
Is that how much? I think it's only like $25, isn't it?
Okay.
Whatever.
That's still
finance.google.com. Can you do finance.microsoft.com? No. No. Finance.bing.com. Let's see here. What is it? MSFT.
Yeah.
Right? Microsoft Corporation. Give me loading. Oh, 36.
So it's 36. So, how many? How many millions?
333 million. It's a lot. He's worth like $1 billion.
Oh,
that's nice.
Like 10.
So, is it 10 billion? My bad.
Yeah.
He doesn't need the compensation. So yeah. Anyways. Yeah, $18 million to run Microsoft, and those awards will be paid out over 3 years, I guess, or in three overlapping five-year periods. I don't even know what that means.
I read an article today about that was like a huge indictment of the current state of the technology industry, especially the leaderships. And he basically was like chastising them as like they're basically Wall Street clones, where they're just insanely profitable. They're doing all sorts of consolidation of technology. They're buying up tiny companies. You've got the big three. He was criticizing them that they're mostly white males that are making all the money. Really? Like, okay. That one's a big one to get into, but you know it was just like it was this big, and it's funny when you get into this type of money. Yeah, outside of that is one point. Outside of the Wall Street banks, there are not many people that get compensated like that. You know, even in the CEO ballpark, that's pretty good money.
Not bad. So we'll obviously be following closely, and any missteps we will document thoroughly. Anything they do well, we will mention in passing. And
I'll probably complain more about Quagmire's and missed opportunities.